This kind of slipped by unnoticed. Now, I heard Rob Manfred's news conference, and I kind of tweaked on to this, but I really didn't put two and two together. Luckily, we have people like Jason Stark of The Athletic to do that. And Jason mentioned that if you go back and look at what Rob Manfred said yesterday and all the stuff, he made a comment about Major League Baseball, quote, not making any specific rule change proposals to the players. So think about that. I don't know if that would include the universal DH. I wouldn't think so. I would think that's probably on the table. But all this stuff about the shift and the pitch clock, Kevin, all this stuff we debated, as of now, it looks as if it's not going to be on the bargaining table. Now, very quickly, I will explain a couple of things about this. First of all, it can be added at any time, right, in any proposal. But Jason Stark walks us through this, and there's a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, there is a concern on the part of ownership that if you put too much stuff on the table, and I think a concern on the part of players as well, that if you put too much stuff on the table, it's just something to be traded off, right? So in other words, if you put 15 things in your proposal and you really only want five of them, you're willing to get rid of 10 of them. And I think the concern was, okay, is everybody serious about rules changes? Or if you were the owners, or even if you were the players and you got some sort of economic benefit in the new CBA, would you say, you know what, if you give us this, we'll take this off the table? Or if you give us this, we'll agree to doing this. So if those rules changes are off the table, one of two things can happen. One, as Jason points out, Major League Baseball's talked about forming a committee of players to look into this, players and executives and general managers and managers. And the other thing is, quite frankly, Rob Manfred, if he wants, can unilaterally declare these rule changes as long as he gives a year. Now, everybody, a year's notice, everybody who has done any reporting on this says it's pretty clear that Rob Manfred does not want to unilaterally throw rules changes out there. So that is a background, Kevin. Does this surprise you, or do you just think that there's so many economic issues on the table that this is let's get the game back on the field first, and then we can address the issues about rules?
Yeah, happy Friday, everybody. For me, it may make you wonder if they're so far apart on the key issues that both sides are wanting to be taken care of, that the little parts of it, like making a base bigger or you can't step off a bag to throw to first, you know, the pitch clock thing, that's an easy one. Like, you just throw that in. What side could say no to that? It makes the game a little quicker. It's not a big deal.
I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah. Because you played the game. You don't think pitchers or hitters would have a problem with, because then if you're a hitter, that means you can't step out and adjust your wristbands.
Some of the little things are silly. It's like the stepping off and not being able to throw to first base however many times you can throw over there, the base being bigger. That sounds like an easy way or a forced way to make players be something they're not. You know, you pay for specific things that players do. That's what it is. You want more stolen bases? You pay for it. You pay for guys stealing 30 or 40. You make it worth their while in the offseason. They work on sprint drills. You just don't force it or make it a little bit easier because the base is bigger. It's a shorter distance between first to second, second and third. That for me is a little bit of a silly thing. So I can understand maybe why that's not why they want to throw those kind of talks in there. But the other things of it, like a pitch clock, that for me is that's a no-brainer. Like, just watch a game. Like, it's not one side can raise their hand and go, I'm not for that. That's a huge deal. We don't want that in there, or we're not going to give you this. It's, you sort of live to fight another day kind of thing. And I for me, on the flip side of it, I just think it makes you wonder a little bit on the key parts of it, the getting paid, the young guys getting paid sooner. The tanking part of it, for me, that they may be a little bit further apart on those two parts of it. Cause I don't know about you, but when you watch and listen to what the union, the Players Association wants, that those two things seem to be the biggest two issues is, you know, you want to get paid quicker and you don't want teams tanking. Well, how is there a middle ground between those two kind of things? And just for me, when I was listening to you talk about the rule part of the game, those are no-brainers. Like, it's just, why you have to have seven people sitting in a room talking about those kind of things when there's bigger parts of the game that need to be taken care of? That's just the way I look at it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is obvious that that there are a lot of core economic issues that need addressing, and I think you're right. I think it's probably smart not to address it right now. I find it interesting that so much of the talk about this came from the commissioner's office. I mean, this is why they've employed Theo Epstein. This is why he's got a job there right now, is to come up with ideas like this. And I found it interesting that we heard so much about it. And it could very well have been part of baseball's labor strategy. Almost, how would you describe it? A red herring. Talk a lot about something and get the players thinking about it. And then when you sit down to negotiate, don't put it on the table. You know, there is kind of a fog of war aspect to this. But I think you're right. I think that there's an understanding, and I don't think anybody's surprised by this. I don't believe anybody thought there would be an agreement. I really don't. I mean, I just don't think either side really. I wouldn't say they didn't negotiate in good faith, but I don't think they negotiated to get an agreement.
Sides do that when there's a ton of money being thrown around on both sides. I just don't think that's going to happen. I'm with you.
I don't think they cared.
I don't know about you, but the way you listen to people that matter in baseball that make big decisions, it sounds like the universal DH has already happened. Like they're obviously hadn't came out and said that this is the way it's going to be and it's going to be in both leagues. But just to listen to players talk and listen to Rob Manfred talk, it just sounds like it's already happened. That's why it's, you know, that they'll gloss over it whenever they say the universal DH. And then again, everything else, look, it's not something, again, you're going to waste, you know, 2 hours arguing back and forth about how bases need to be bigger or a lefty can't step off the bag and throw to first base more than however many times they can throw over. Those things for me are silly. There's bigger issues that need to be taken care of for the game to be headed in the right direction. At least both sides think so. And until those issues are taken care of, I think you sort of, you know, I don't want to say you wipe it under the sweep it under the rug, but you just sort of, you know, kind of forget about it until you actually have to think about it.
Travis Sawchuk is a reporter who's done a lot of work on the economics of the game. We'll be joined, by the way, in a few minutes by Jeff Passan. But Travis Sawchuk's a reporter who's done a lot of work on the economics of the game, and he threw out some numbers there today on social media that I just wanted to kind of run by people, because we talked yesterday about the battle or the battle lines over minimum salary and things of that nature and how important arbitration is. And we threw out some numbers about players and how many players last year didn't earn. You know, everybody thinks every Major League Baseball player is a millionaire, and the fact of the matter is the vast majority of them didn't earn $1 million. This is Travis Sawchuk looking at 2019, which is the last year that we have complete game level data. Pre-arbitration eligible players. This is interesting, Kevin. Pre-arbitration eligible players accounted for 63.2% of all players to step on the field. They accounted for 50% of the days of service time, but only 9.8% of player pay. No major North American pro league leans on minimum salaried players like Major League Baseball, and no pro league pays the lower minimum salary. People need to think about that when they're looking at the players. And just look at the Blue Jays. How many times, especially until the bullpen was settled, how many times was the Buffalo Express working? All those guys that are coming up, they're all not making much money. They're not millionaires. Like, trust me, none of those guys are millionaires that are being brought up from Buffalo and sent down and brought up and sent down. So the minimum is, the Major League minimum is the lowest of any pro league in North America, and minimum salaried players are leaned on more than any other group. And this is why I wanted to bring you in here, Kevin, because Travis also makes an interesting point. You can take a ball player who, let's say he doesn't put together a run of service time until he's 28. That happens with guys. Guys bounce up and down, up and down, up and down. All of a sudden, they stick at 28.
Late bloomers.
Late bloomers. As Travis Sochuk points out, operating under the assumption that that player or pitcher has been in the minors a lot of the time, they're not making much money.
Nope.
I mean, you know, we used to not laugh, but we used to talk about how guys wanted to get called up to the majors for major league meal money.
September.
Mm-hmm. That's a real issue. That's
huge.
That's lots of money in the pockets. That's why I didn't like limiting September call-ups, because for a lot of guys, that's the difference, frankly, between not making a profit on their year, because they're businessmen. That's the difference between losing money and not making a profit.
Absolutely. You make more.
If you're a minor leaguer and you got three kids, you're not making money.
You make more in 1 month than you'd make in the 6 months that you're in the minor leagues, or the 5 months, or whatever it is. The only issue that I have with, because I was probably one of those guys that got called up and, you know, based my year around, I wanted to have certain good months. So that put it in those people that were running those teams' minds that I was a good player and I was being warranted being called up in September because I was going to make a lot more money then than I would make the years. Now, obviously, because I was in AAA more than most people, I was making a bigger salary in AAA than most guys that were in AAA, because now it's a younger league. You want to get to the point where, Jeff, I don't know about you, but you don't want to water it down. How it's just not your – because you know as well as anybody, just because you call somebody up doesn't make them a big leaguer. How do you make sure that when you are in the big leagues and you are being paid for it, there's a reason for it, that you are one of the best players in all of baseball. You're just not being called up and getting paid because you haven't earned it, is basically my point here. And that for me is there's a fine line here. How much give will there be from the Players Association and the union with the owners, because they're basically the union and the Players Association is basically wanting players to be paid just because they're getting called up, not because they're any good at it. That for me is where I'm a little gray on how this is going to work out and how much give there's going to be between the two sides. That's the whole goal. Is when you're a player, you don't always want to be the 25th guy. You mm-hmm. want to make yourself in, you know, the 20th guy, the 18th guy, the 17th guy. You don't always want to be the 25th guy. And how is that 25th guy going to be paid like everybody else? And how does the union sell that to ownership? Because that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get these guys paid no matter what, no matter how good they are, just because they've been called up to the big leagues like a big leaguer. I don't know if I'm in with that or not. And I was sort of one of those guys. So that for me... I just don't know how you sell that. I don't know how you sell one side of it, right? More than the other side of, there's a fine line there. How do you do it? Tell me how you do it. Cause I don't know. I'm not sure. I sat down last night and tried to figure out and tried to put myself in that position on. I was one of those players that had been in the minor leagues for 6 or 7 years before you get called up. Now, I wasn't one of those guys, but I'm with you. The guys that are trying to get to the big leagues for that little certain amount of time and get paid like it. But if you're an owner, you're thinking to yourself, why would I pay this person that way? Mm-hmm. That's the big thing, is that's the big hurdle that these guys are going to try and have to get past, is there's got to be a line here. There's got to be a little give and take, and who's given and who's taken. That's the question for me anyway.
I think the biggest unknown here, I guess, is when owners put forth a proposal basing pre-arb payroll or basing pre-arb salary using WAR, in other words, trying to institute wins above replacement as a means of measuring a player's value and therefore determining how a player would get paid. This is the first really contentious labor dispute baseball has had since the advent of analytics, and I wonder if maybe we haven't overlooked that. You know, analytics is, it's a two-edged sword, right? There's some players have benefited from analytics because there's specific skill sets that, You know, look at those relievers. Look at spin rate. Guys who in other years wouldn't have gotten a look in the majors, people are noticing their spin rate, and their, you know, their technology is identifying guys that in the past may not have been able to be late bloomers. You talked about you. Mm-hmm. Who knows what your career would have been like if analytics and R&D had been there. Somebody may have noticed something about Barker's swing.
Absolutely. And said,
man, we get that dude in here. We get Barker in here and working that swing. We got something.
Yes, sir.
So it's worked for guys, but I think on the other hand, I think it's also hurt some of the older players. Right? I think analytics have hurt some of the older players because now there is a mathematical format to go to a 34-year-old guy making $12, $15 million a year and saying, yeah, we can get that from you for $15 million a year, or I can pay two guys $3 million a year and get the same thing because I can quantify what they're going to give my team versus what you give the team. So I don't – that's another thing that maybe we've kind of overlooked in all this is I don't know how the sides determine how they are going to use – how they are going to – codify the use of analytics in the game. I guess maybe when Passan joins us, we'll ask him that. It's that is a very contentious and complicated issue. Oh, we do have Jeff Passan. Great. Jeff Passan of ESPN joining us. Mr. Passan, how's the lockout treating you? Pretty good so far, hey?
Oh, yeah. It's been delightful, let me tell you. Labor strife is actually, you might be the one person I know who kind of digs labor strife, Blair.
I don't dig labor strife.
Blair, give me a break. You love talking about it. You always love talking about labor. You got to admit to that much, at least.
Well, it does interest me. Although I have to admit, as I get older, my level of BS, yeah. My level of you know what I'm saying, right? You get to a certain point where I go, there's got to be something else on TV.
Jeff, he has had a glow the last couple of days that he normally doesn't have.
I'm telling you.
Yeah, he has. I'm with you.
I know him.
Oh, yeah.
I know him. By the way, let me just get this out of the way, because I heard the top of the show.
Yeah.
I do not think I know what the commissioner said yesterday. I was there. Mm-hmm. I don't think that on-field rules changes are off the table at all. I think they will be brought back at the end. Some of them, at least, mm-hmm. as like a last-minute lanyap.
Right.
Just because you can't talk about them now because it's just another divisive issue amid a bunch of many more, much greater divisive issues. But mm-hmm. it's one of those things where, for some guys, it is a total third rail, and you just don't want to introduce the potential of chaos in the middle of something combustible right now. Get the main stuff, the important stuff done, and then you can talk about something like on-field rule changes.
Yeah, I was told by people who've been involved in negotiations, this goes back years, but that because I asked Donald Fehr one time, how do you go about doing this? I mean, how do you sit down and how do you go about figuring this whole thing out? Not coming to an agreement, just what you want. And he and other people have said the same thing. Look, you come up with a wish list, and then you kind of prioritize. You look at your wish list and go, there's no chance in hell we're getting that. You look at what you think the owner's wish list is going to be, and you basically try to find some things that you know you agree on, and then you throw those off to the side. Like, there's a lot of paperwork and a lot of technical stuff that both sides agree on that just has to get done. It's stuff that's there. And then you kind of divide it into what they want and what we want. And then you prioritize. And I think I'm sure the sides have already gone through that and done that. And perhaps you're right.
No, they haven't. They haven't actually. That's the frustrating part.
You don't think the players know the guts of what they want out of this?
Oh, I think they know what they want, but I don't think that either side has very clearly identified what the other is wanting right now. And I think that especially goes for the league looking at the union. And if you see what happened, it was really interesting because on the day before the lockout, it was lockout day. So it was back on Wednesday. There were some union officials who were pissed, and they were pissed because they felt like the league was asking them to, in order to see a proposal from the league was putting conditions on it, which is that we're not going to talk about service time. So we're not going to talk about anything less than 6 years of service before free agency. We're not going to talk about service time manipulation because that's just a really complicated thing in a service-based system to get through. And we're not going to talk about revenue sharing. So essentially what Major League Baseball was trying to do, I think, was take some things off the table just to see what the union actually wants to prioritize. That felt like the strategy there. And the union's like, we're not taking anything off the table at this point. So if you don't want to give us a proposal, if you want to go into a lockout without having made a core economics proposal to us in our last meeting, that is fine. And Major League Baseball said, okay. And the meeting ended after 7 minutes. And that was the last time they met before the lockout.
Jeff, what's the attitude been like from Tony Clark and Rob Manfred? I always wondered what that would be like. Do they hate each other? Are they pointing fingers? Are they professional? How does that work? How's that going?
They definitely don't hate each other. I think I'm not sure if I've ever tried to characterize the relationship between them. I think they're adversaries, right?
Yeah.
And I think adversaries are always going to have some level of respect for one another because very few understand what it's like to be in their seat. You know, that's one thing they will always have. They will always know what it's like to be a boss of a big sprawling group of people with disparate thoughts, feelings, emotions, ideas, plans, and having to wrangle those. Now, in Clark's case, it's 1,200 young players, most of whom don't really, frankly, care about labor until they start losing paychecks. In Manfred's case, it's 30 billionaires who all think they're the smartest guy in the world. So that's, you know, they're different constituencies, but I think they respect one another because of the jobs. I think there are certainly things that both think the other could be a lot better at and both think are problematic to the process.
Which side do you think has to give first for talks to start up again?
Well, if we look at what's been given at this point, let's look at the actual gives right now. MLB offered to give direct draft pick compensation away, meaning that when the Blue Jays tender a qualifying offer to Robbie Ray, and Robbie Ray goes, and by the way, I wouldn't be saying this as an example if they didn't get Gausman. So, like, even trade there. But with Robbie Ray going to Seattle, the Jays get a pick, but the Mariners also give one up that sort of just disappears and goes into the ether. And the argument has always been, guys, that, you know, the cost of that draft pick, every team has a fixed dollar value on it. And essentially whatever that dollar value is gets presumably taken out of the contract going to the player. The union, of course, doesn't like that, and that's what direct draft pick compensation is. And if you get rid of direct draft pick compensation, then theoretically players are going to be paid more in free agency and you're going to get some money there. So that's what the league has offered at this point. The union has offered to expand playoffs, though. The union's offer doesn't make a ton of sense. They've offered to go from 10 to 12 teams, but it would necessitate a realignment that ends up with 8 teams in one division and 7 teams in another. So it would be a two division realignment. There's not going to be realignment. So that plan you know, I'm not sure if they're going to end up at the 14 that MLB wants. There's definitely concern about that, but they've put that on the table, and they've put uniform patches, which would, you know, be worth X amount of dollars on the table. But that's really all the trading that's been done so far. So I think the move, just because it's Major League Baseball's turn, quote unquote, to make a core economics proposal, is probably going to come from the league, but I don't anticipate it being a particularly big one.
You know, we saw the proposal regarding the use of WAR as a determinant for salary.
Yeah.
I mean, that intrigued me for a variety of reasons. First of all, this is the first labor stoppage since the advent of analytics, but it's the first sort of R&D age labor stoppage. And
sabermetric, you know, revolution. There you go.
Sabermetric revolution. And Jeff, I guess it kind of makes sense that at some point a game that would so value analytics would, at some point, it would have to figure out a way to codify how that impacts the economic structure of the game in a way that both sides can kind of understand it. Like, I'm looking at this from the point of view of an older free agent. Like, analytics aren't necessarily, they're not the kindest thing in the world to the 34-year-old outfielder. We've already talked about how emotion is largely out of the game now, you know. And I'm wondering, at the end of the day, isn't this sort of the nut of the thing, in that there has to be a way to value a player or attach a value to him that both sides are comfortable with, especially because it seems to me that, you know, all the writing and all the research we've seen on the increased use of players who are earning Major League minimum or less than Major League minimum, right? That kind of, when you have an opener, you're opening the door for all sorts of stuff to happen. I guess what I'm getting at is, I don't know how you kind of put this all in a package, Jeff, that everybody can understand and agree with. I don't know how you do that.
I just have a difficult time, Jeff, seeing arbitration boiled down to any single statistic. Let's remember, the virtue of arbitration is that for the first time in your career, you get to argue for your salary, right? You get to say, I feel like what I've done to this point makes me worth this. And as any worker anywhere knows, the ability to argue for salary is a very, very important one. If you're in a job and you just have rote 2-4% raises every year, despite the fact that you feel like you've been putting in not just good work, but better work than your peers, that's frustrating. And so I think, you know, rather than be boiled down to a particular number, and if I may just say, a flawed number at that, I like wins above replacement. It is not a be-all, end-all. And the only thing you need to see to know that is the fact that Baseball Reference wins above replacement. It can be at times wildly different from Fangraphs. So the notion that there are you know, multiple ways to calculate the same thing that you're measuring. No, you stick with the statistics that are there, that not that are run through a formula in order to get it. If a guy hit 260 and slugged 530 and got on base 370, those are numbers that are well established and allow you, based on precedent, to go and argue in favor of your case to have a higher salary. And yeah, WAR is in there already. It's in arbitration rooms and arbitration discussions every time they happen, but it's not the thing that's solely determining what a player's salary is going to be.
We had Greg Boris on yesterday, former communications director with the Players Association. And one of the things he was talking about is, you know, when you look at negotiations and when you look at the negotiating room, one of the things you have to keep in mind is that in addition to the players versus owners, there's also an aspect of owners versus owners. And he said, you know, and this got to your point, right? You got 30 guys who all think they're the smartest guy in the room. They've all they've got a ton of money. Most of them have been successful in another endeavor. And his point was that sometimes actually you'll find an issue where some owners will align with players, and it can get complicated for Rob or whoever the commissioner is to try to balance this out. Now, look, I remember it used to be easy. You used to look at owners, you'd go Jerry Reinsdorf, devil incarnate, Peter Angelos, labor guy, good guy. So Peter Angelos was the guy you liked, and he's, you know, and then you tried to find two or three other doves, and quite often Beeston was one of the guys that was in the dovish camp, and then you had all these other guys you hated. Do we have an idea? Like, I don't know about you, but when I see that Richard Montfort is leading on the negotiating committee for the owners, this is a guy whose franchise is a tire fire. I don't know if I want him sitting in a room making a deal. I don't want my franchise run like the Rockies. I'm sorry. I really don't. Do we know yet who the quote unquote power brokers are among owners, and whether or not there may be kind of a divide? You know, typically it's a big market, small market divide, but I'm told that it's not that easy now.
No, and that has yet to reveal itself at this point. I feel like that's going to be one of the big stories over the next 60 to 90 days as this whole thing plays out, which is about how long I anticipate it's going to be. Listen, I don't know about you, Jeff. I think that this probably gets done before the beginning of March, or at very latest, like a week into March. Because we're inveterate gamblers in the sports writing community, Bob Nightingale yesterday put a pool together in which the six of us who were there covering the event all pledged $20 and put a date down. And I put February 17th. So I think 2.5 months from now, we're going to have a much better idea. Listen, they're all power brokers, right? Just by nature of what they do. It's a question which ones are going to be willing to use some of the capital that they have. And I don't think there's any one to the player side right now who is friendly from the owner side. I don't know that guy exists right now. I think for the criticism that you can throw Rob Manfred's way, one thing that Major League Baseball has done a very good job of up to this point is trying to illustrate that the owners, despite their disparate markets and backgrounds, are in lockstep and in unison when it comes to labor.
We saw Taiwan Walker, Jameson Taillon, change their avatar on Twitter. Solidarity. How do you think social media will play in maybe putting pressure on either side to come to an agreement?
Can I ask a question about the word solidarity?
Yeah.
Is five guys doing something really solidarity?
Not really.
To me, like I said, I June Lee from ESPN talked to Trevor Williams and Trevor May, and they were just talking about how it's like a funny meme. This could have been solidarity, like if every single player goes out and changes his avatar to the blank one.
Yeah.
That's pretty good right there. That's a pretty good message. Mm-hmm. As it stood, I just thought it was like a funny little troll. Mm-hmm. And this is not to minimize what solidarity the union does have, which I think for the most part it does at this point. Let's put it this way. I don't think if you talk to like the average player that he would be able to elucidate exactly what the union is fighting for here, because I think there's a pretty decent level of disengagement among players right now, but those who are engaged are very engaged. And the ones who are very engaged don't just stand behind the principles that the union are espousing, but look at the other side, look at Manfred, look at Montfort, and just think to themselves, these are the people who are running our sport? Really? Like, this is how they're treating us right now? The people who are the game? And I hope that fans in a labor dispute understand and recognize the players are the game. They just are. The laundry's not the game. The laundry is something that you can buy. The hats are something that you can wear. They're all expressions of fandom. But they're not the game. The game does not exist without the people who are best at something in the world going out there and showing why they are the best and how they are the best and doing the sorts of incredible things that people who aren't the best in the world are incapable of doing.
Yeah, that's really well said. We've had long conversations on this show and elsewhere with Tom Glavine about what he went through when he was part of the negotiating committee in 94. I mean, he got booed. Mm-hmm. He got booed at home for years. And the one of the real concerns I have in this, because of social media, is in the past, everybody's been smart enough to realize that you don't personalize this. You don't turn it into Vladdy Jr.'s greedy. You don't. You can't do that if you're an owner. You can't do that if you're Rob.
Right. Here's the thing, though. What I'm most interested in as this whole thing plays out is, in terms of social media at least, who's the person who was trending two nights ago?
No, who was?
Take a guess. On the night that Major League Baseball locks out the players, who do you think is the most obvious person?
Max Scherzer.
Rob Manfred. Oh. It was Rob Manfred. And he was at the top.
Okay.
And if you look at the reaction to Rob Manfred, listen, I'm only going through the echo chamber that is Twitter, but not polling particularly well there. and I wonder if at any point the union starts making this about Rob Manfred. That would be a dirty tactic. It would sort of go against past the way that they've operated in the past. But it's wartime, baby, right?
That's a great point. One of the things Greg Boras told us is, they always. Social media didn't exist then, but he said, I'm willing to bet that Tony Clark's first message, first of all, think about what you're tweeting. But secondly, if you're tweeting something, make it positive about us, not negative about them. Right. Make it our points are good. Our points are valid. And I just, I'm with you. I don't think we're going to see anything until February 1st. My concern, though, is I don't know if these guys can maintain discipline for 2 months. Can these guys be disciplined, not just players, but owners? Can Steve Cohen be disciplined for 2 months?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Well, I don't know.
I don't either. And part of me wonders how much does the public messaging matter? Like, is the public messaging at any point going to affect the policy? And I don't see that happening, but if it's going to happen, I think, I have trouble seeing. I know there are people out there who are always going to portray the players as greedy, which I don't get, because they're just trying to get their share of what they help generate. And with that share having gone down as significantly as it has, it's not like they're sitting here asking for more when they've already got a large piece of the pie. No, right. They're trying to recover what they've lost. But the ability for public action to shape policy, I'm definitely, that's one of the stories I'm keeping an eye on, because I don't know how that's going to go, frankly.
Mr. Passan, great insight as always. We are going to let you run. Hopefully, you'll get a little bit of downtime here. And who knows? Maybe the next time we'll talk, we'll be talking. No, maybe. Who knows? Maybe this thing. No, it's not. It's not going to be solved. It won't be solved until February.
No, definitely not.
I'm with you.
Yep.
Thanks for Thanks for doing this as always, my friend.
Thanks.
Be well.
See you, boys. Have a good one.
Take care. Jeff Passan of ESPN. We will take a break and come back and wrap it up and give you a little idea about the Blair and Barker schedule as it sets up. This is Blair and Barker on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. We will be doing a weekly podcast through the winter, which will drop, as the kids say, every Thursday. There may be a slight alteration in around the holiday season, but I doubt it. We'll aim for dropping it every Thursday, maybe Wednesday. And don't worry, we'll find it is not going to be Labor 101. We've got a lot of things we're going to talk about with a lot of different people. Talk to some players about how they're staying in shape during the lockout, things of that nature. And maybe even do a little. Maybe even get Kevin Barker to tell us his five best winter ball stories.
Ooh.
that are suitable for airing.
I do have some good ones.
Yeah, that are suitable for airing.
Three out of the five are.
Yeah. I know the one that isn't, but anyhow, one of the two. I think I know that one. Anyhow, point aside is, and then of course, if anything breaks involving labor, you know, one of us will be around. We'll be talking about it. But I think I'm on board with Jeff Passan, frankly. I'm not paying attention to anything about baseball labor till February 1st, unless somebody takes to Twitter and says something really stupid.
Well, you know it's going to happen. It'll happen.
I got my suspects. Steve Cohen will say something really dumb, and he just is. I guarantee you, he's going to tweet something really dumb, and it's going to create confusion. It's probably not going to be, deadly, but it's going to create confusion.
Not going to help.
No. Player side, I don't know. The players in the past generally have maintained pretty good discipline. Trevor Bauer's kind of the resident lunatic, and I don't think anybody would, Trevor Bauer's suspended, so I don't think he has any cachet. He would be the one player most likely to say something really, 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 really stupid. That's kind of where we are going forward. So again, our pod will drop every Thursday. I'll be on social media letting you know when it drops and what we're all about. And I don't know, maybe we have so much technology at our fingertips. Maybe we'll have a few surprises for you as well. But Kevin, as we wrap up today's show, I wanted to ask you this. Look, we've all talked about how February is when the rubber really meets the road here for everybody. Spring training, it's about February 14th. Grapefruit League season starts late in February. Opening day is March 31st. I think right now nobody expects opening day to not happen, although Greg Boris said yesterday he thinks there will be some regular season games lost. Like, we can worry about that down
Hope
the road.
Not.
As we get to the end of January, you're a player, and you're a guy who had to go to spring training to win a job.
Yeah.
Put me in the mind of if Kevin Barker were 23, 24 years old, this February, and you got a shot at getting an everyday job with the Milwaukee Brewers, what would your mindset be like not knowing when spring training is going to start?
Yeah, I would have been a top prospect then. I was at the time, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I was the Brewers' top prospect. That's a little different than, when you're uber rich, you're established at the big league level, this will not affect you at all. You already have places to work out. You know routines. You know what has worked in the past. You already have a job, which is the most important part out of all of that. Now, if you're a guy that's coming in that could be the 27th, 28th guy, and you're trying to, impress. You want to go, hey, manager, look at me. Look how good I am. How good I can get the foot down and get it singing and stay in the big part of the field. I can run after a ball. I can throw it to the right base. I know how to go first to third, second to home, all those things. And the only way I'm going to show that is for them to be seeing me. Now, all of a sudden, you got some worries because probably those kind of guys don't have jobs yet. They don't even have minor league jobs yet. Now, I don't think this affects a whole lot of minor league guys because it's affecting more the 40-man and the guys that can't go work out. So, it's those guys that are on the 40-man, that are on the bubble. Those are the guys that are going to be affected. The minor league guys, listen, it is what it is. You sort of, at the part of your career, know who you are as a player. You know where you're at. In the eyes of that organization, you know what you have to do. And, most of those guys know if they need to be playing winter ball, if You know, if they can somehow get the word out that, you know, it's that guy that was hurt at the end of the season last year that didn't play a ton, now has to go and, you know, is starting to catch up to velocity in winter ball, can sort of get the word out that, hey, I'm okay. I can be free and easy. It's fluid. It looks nice. My finish is there. All the things that need to be seen that I'm okay to be a big leaguer when all this thing hits the ground and I can be a part of it. So it's, you know, the game's changed so much when I was a player to now that I'm just not sure how it affects these guys when it comes to the guy that's the bubble that doesn't have a job yet. That's the most important, that guy that's going to affect everybody else. Look, you know who you are. You know what you have to do. You know analytics.
Even a guy like Bo. Let's say even a young guy like Bo.
Oh, yeah. Bo knows who he is. Bo has, you know, we always hear about Bo doing things with other players home with his dad. Analytics, you know, the back elbow dropping that, getting the barrel in the hitting zone long enough, catching up to velocity. You know, what's he going to do to tweak the leg kick, the size of it? Can he have a two-strike approach? All the things that Bo can do because he's uber-talented can do that before the bell rings. He's a different animal. And then there's everybody else, right? So I just don't think it affects – if this would have happened 15 years ago, mm-hmm. I think this would have been a bigger deal. Now I think the way players are trained, the way it's beat into their head of what they have to do, they know now they can't hit ground balls. You adjust your routines in the offseason to allow you to be able to do that consistently. So that for me is – I think what you have to do is just the guys that don't have a job yet. You know, the guys that are in the bubble, the guy, the 27th, 28th guy who's not really a minor leaguer, who's not really a big leaguer, who, you know, is fighting for what do you do now? Do I try and make a run at this? Do I wait? Or do I try and find a new career? And there's more of those mm-hmm. guys than there should be. And that's the guys for me that I worry about that, you know, are losing sleep at night because I was one of those guys. There'll be a time. And I think maybe it's rushed now, the time for those guys because of what they're going through with all this stuff that's happened. It's bad. It's a bad time for those guys. It really is.
No, that's, you know, whenever any of these things happen, that's, you know, my thoughts go to the guys who are, as you said, the 25th, 26th, not the 25th guy. He's probably got a contract, but the guy who might be the first guy called up from AAA. Those are the guys that, you know, I kind of worry about. And you're right. I mean, the fact of the matter is there will be guys who don't play baseball again.
No.
As a result of this.
It's terrible.
It's sad.
It's terrible to think about. Yeah.
Bark, thanks for doing this. Blair and Barker, the podcast, drops every Thursday. Have a great weekend.